Thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast on CelticUnderground.net. This is a free podcast. Of course, listeners will know that we have now launched our Substack on thecelticunderground.substack.com. So this is a two-part podcast with Andrew H. Smith talking about his time at Celtic, both pre and post Fergus, but specifically once Fergus was in and was making all the changes and what it was like to work very closely with Fergus, as Andrew did at the Celtic View. Talks about his time finding an actual biscuit tin full of money when the old board were there. It's a brilliant listen with some great impersonations of Fergus from Andrew. It is a two-part podcast. Part one is free. Part two will be available for everybody who subscribes to thecelticunderground.substack.com. So this is me, Harry Brady, with him, Andrew H. Smith. Joined now by Andrew Smith. Now, we've done a podcast before, Andrew, so I just get the niceties out of the way. What happened to the H?
It was, I put it in because I wanted to seem a bit more writerly. And when the old board sold the Celtic View because it was losing money, So they sold it to First Press Publishing, which was a very kind of tabloidy publishing house. So it was run by Steve Sampson, who was the youngest ever editor on Fleet Street in The Sun. It's like I think he was maybe just out of his teens, but it was also people like Bill Leckie, and Bill Leckie was one. He was the production editor or something. So he says to me, "What's that, Poncy? You don't do that in tabloids." So it had to go. So it wasn't actually my decision to remove the H. The H was forcibly removed.
So do you like the H?
I still write it in my signature. Right. I still write it in my signature. I wanted to change my name to Hannaway. And I was getting the deed poll stuff and all that, and my dad got really upset. He says, "Why is Smith no good enough for you?" I says, "Because I don't sound like a writer. Andrew Hannaway, let's be honest about it, that sounds like a writer, doesn't it?"
Yeah, yeah.
But at the last minute, I couldn't do it to my dad.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about why writers might have poncy names.
Or just be ponces. Like,
we're a wee bit late on doing this podcast, but it's the 30th anniversary of Fergus acquiring Celtic. One of talking of people who fit the stereotype, I always remember somebody saying to me, "Look at him coming in off Glasgow Airport with all his belongings in poly bags."
Yeah.
And I said, "That's why he's a millionaire."
And that was very much why he was a millionaire, you know.
Because he didn't waste
money. "Two pairs of these shoes for $15, he would say. I remember him telling people in Celtic, you know, they're standing at the urinal together, "Hey, look at these shoes." And then he says, "Two pairs, $15. So the person beside us, "All right, mate, great.
So, and again, we're not here to talk about people pissing in your
head. Oh, sorry.
So it's 30 years. Now, we've done podcasts with some of the key players in the all the Sales for Change stuff, and I've read and listened to quite a bit in the last couple of weeks.
Me too. There's been some really good stuff, I have to say.
Yeah, but everybody's going to have their own, particularly people who were involved directly in it, it's going to have their own prejudices. We all remember stuff that misses out the bits where we've been not so great and remember all the times when we've been so great. So what was unique about you was you were there and had to do that transition of being the guy who was writing about how Campus Lang was brilliant and Gryffindor were the greatest merchant bank ever. And then...
Wasn't it all my words? Can I just say that? It wasn't all my words.
And then had to transform into you were there when Fergus was there. So the point being, you were a fly in the wall who had no dog in the fight specifically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that you were just there to be the guy who ran the Celtic View. You ran it under the old board and then ran it when Fergus took over. So you had a ringside seat and a sort of really stereotypical fly in the wall that you were listening to the side of the old board, and then when Fergus came in, listening to the position of them. So I thought it'd be really good to get you on, and there'll be other stuff that you will be talking about shortly, but have you on to talk about that time?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, We never thought it was... We thought, they seem to believe Canvas Lang. I'll tell you what summed it up that Monday. That Monday, when we were producing that view, you know, when we had to get the picture taken, Kevin Kelly looking like Julie Andrews, you know, like in The Sound of Music. You know, the hills were alive with the sound of kind of toxic waste, you know. Although Michael Kelly will always tell you that eventually that's where they built the printing presses, didn't they? For the
Was it that end that they built it? Because I can never get my head around exactly.
So they did use it. It did become. And I think when you have like kind of degraded land and all that, you can put things like that on it. You couldn't put housing on it or whatever, would you? But you can.
Well, so the problem with housing is on contaminated land is if somebody then starts digging it up and putting their plants in the
Right. Whereas if you put a print press, you know, it's just a big warehouse.
Yeah, if you put a big shed or yeah, yeah. blocks of flats are okay on it because people don't tend to do the gardens.
Right. So that Monday, it was like, it's all going ahead. So we had to get the picture of him. And Michael Kelly phoned me up. He said, Andrew, he said, I know you're a bit kind of sceptical of all this. He said, but what I want you to do is, fax me over, this is how far back we go, fax me over your 10 most difficult questions you can think of about this whole venture, about what we're going to do here with the investment bank and how we're going to raise the other capital, how we're going to 60,000 all-seater stadium in Canvas Lang. I said, okay. Sat down, barred them all out. So I faxed them back because obviously it was in town where the Celtic View was published and put together and all the kind of typesetting, such like, well, online typesetting, but all that stuff was done in an office in town. So I wasn't up at Celtic. Monday I always had to get down there to get the thing finished. So I faxed them off and he says, I'll get back to you in half an hour went. That's what I remember. It was getting about 2:30. And like, all right, what's up? And I says, are they ready yet? Yeah, he said, yeah, I'm just ready. So they faxed back the 10 questions, except there was four of the questions, my questions, had disappeared.
They were too hard.
Three of the questions that I'd sent had been, like, redefined, shall we say. And, like, then there'd been... Four new questions. What would that be? Would that
four out and four new ones. Three changed.
And then or maybe there was three that remained the same then. Was it three remained the same? Three. And so four completely changed, three manipulated, and three survived out of the 10. And I thought, whoa, that's like, because I think one of the questions was like, where are you going to, I think it was they needed, it was 20 million Geffenor putting in and they had to find another. Was it 20? I can't remember the exact details, but maybe the first question was, where are you going to find the rest of the money? Why are Geffenor giving you this money? I think they were two of the questions. So I was like, right. So that was fine, but still had to go ahead. And he said, I've got to see the pages of this Celtic View, which, believe it or not, didn't always happen then. Wee Fergus made sure it happened subsequently, but no doubt we'll go into that. But so he said, I've got to see all these pages. Because I was singing and dancing over, it was a bit... 9 pages or something. It was like one of those royal pullouts. So we waited again and we waited. We were all in the office. It was after 12. It was after midnight. And he phones up. He said, There's a problem. I said, oh, right. There's a problem. So what is it? And the very same issue, his mother, there'd been a picture taken of his mother as the oldest living shareholder, right? And we put it in page 13. We used to always call it page 13, just where you put the pills picture and all that, where you put, you know, all the pictures that you have to put in, but you can't be bothered, you know. Like, so we stuck it away back in page 13, just above all the pills results and everything. And he said, there's a problem. You've spelled ornithology wrong, because his mum was a... Like, because his mum was really into it. And I says, to be honest with you, I said, you gave me that caption kind of thing. I said, I didn't even know what ornithology was. Like, it was quite ignorant of me then. Is that it? That's the way his mind was working. I mean, I know he can't stand me and all that. Another one will come later on about that one. But I was like, hold on, we're trying to do something that seems very important. And you've more worried about what the caption is in your the picture of your mum with her shareholder to show she's the oldest living shareholder. Not for very long, maybe, as it turned out. Nothing to do with how long his mum lived or whatever, but I just mean what was to happen like later that week, I might add. So we went with it and thought, well, maybe they know better. Maybe they know better. We were always suspicious. I mean, and I joined, that was 94. I joined in 89, and I'd been brought up, and my mother was the football sport, the Celtic sport in my family, and she went on about the Kelly and Whites. I just grew up with that. Mm-hmm. Grew up with that kind of resentment of the Kelly and Whites. She almost couldn't say their names without her lips curdling, you know. There's so many Celtic sport families that would tell you the exact same. So I knew what I was kind of getting into, but I knew Jack McGinn was a bit different. When you think about it, wasn't it all just the Kellys and Whites even then? You know, there was room for, like Jack was on the board, and Jack, I mean, Jack's brother was my parish priest, and I was one of the longest serving, like nepotism, a nepo baby. I was one of the longest serving altar boys in St Mary's and Lark Hall, so, and I got on really well with him. He became a canon, Canon McGinn. So he was my reference for, like, the job, the first job I'd gone for as a kind of Celtic View assistant editor. But even then, you knew it was brewing, And then it all fell apart. The View wasn't even on the shelves when it was Radio Clyde were announcing it at 6 p.m. And you remember that's the night of the Kilmarnock boycott game.
Yeah.
So they announced, Geffinor said, we don't know where this has come from. We want nothing to do with it. We've never agreed to anything. Now, I think Michael Kelly said in his book that he felt they'd been spooked at the negative reaction. I wouldn't entirely rule that out. Maybe they did have some kind of loose arrangement that they thought that this was, they were going to get Geffinor on side, this Swiss banker. And then they saw it was like the hostile environment that they were going to go into. Because they would have been getting calls all day for the newspaper guys. So that was at 6 o'clock. And I thought, I've just been made to look like an idiot. So I phoned up my friend and the son. And I says, look, I want to spill my guts. I want to go down fighting here. I want to so people know that I wasn't just trying to kind of, I wasn't trying to sell them up. You know, I wasn't trying to be dishonest. I honestly believed that this was all going to happen. And I thought, they're going to run the club into oblivion. And I don't want to be part of it. But I don't want them to just resign. I don't want to just resign. What I want to do is, I want to go down in a blaze of glory. So I phoned up my guy in the Sun. I said, will you get me on the back page if I spill my guts here? And I had a phrase in mind. I said, a couple of more weeks of this, they'll need to change my name to Goebbels. Right? And because I knew the way the Sun worked. I'm not being wise after the event, and how smart am I? How manipulative am I? But I knew, that's a great talky headline. You know the Sun loved their talky headlines. Sure enough, 2 more weeks of this, they'll need to change my name to Goebbels. So it came out, and I also knew I was starting as a juror on a high court trial, so I knew they couldn't get to me. That trial went on 4 weeks and was the bane of my life because the club was changing at that time. And it's crazy, I nearly got done for contempt of court because when Fergus actually took over at the club, I was going in from about 6:45 in the morning to about 8:30, and then I would get the bus to the High Court, and then I would come back at 4 o'clock and then work to 7 and then do my whole 12-hour weekends. I mean, I used to do 78 hours a week, Celtic View editor. You could do it in your 20s, can you, But so I knew they couldn't get a hold of me, but they phoned up because they didn't own us. So Michael Kelly phoned up Steve Sampson. He says, I take it you're sacking the little C. Steve Sam says, well, we don't want to make a martyr of him, because he also knew what the Sun would do. Mm-hmm. I'd go from the back page to the front page.
Yeah.
Like, fired for telling the Sun the truth. You know, you can just see it. And in fairness to Steve, he'd say, no, don't give them that, because that's what they want. And I had to go into that office, but he called me in the office. What are you doing? You know, he was like Kelvin McKenzie, Steve Sampson. I mean, I dearly loved him, but he was crazy. Listen, you. He once said to me, when he was owning the club, the players decided to boycott the View because stuff was coming out. They were selling it to the tabloids before the View was actually on the shelves.
Right.
So Paul McStay says, look, me and the players decided we're not speaking to you because we're not speaking to you. We're speaking to the Tabs. So because they were making money, they wanted to make money having they owned the View. It wasn't selling anything then. So they banned, you know, they banned it. And I phoned up, Steve phoned me, I want you down here in my office. I said, look, Steve, I said, I'm the Celtic View editor. So I'm working, these guys are my work colleagues, Paul McStay and the rest of the players. And then I have you as my boss telling me to do something different for them. I said, I'm being told to serve two masters. And he always said to me down the phone, he said, listen, you, because he talked like Kelvin McKenzie, listen, you little philosophical cunt. Get your ass down here. So he had more of that stuff for me that Wednesday. He says, what the hell were you thinking? What the hell were you thinking? I said,
you weren't you doing what he was doing then? If he's taking those quotes from the players and sticking them straight in the paper, that's what you were doing, except it was a quote from you. But it's the same principle.
I know. And I also demanded that they put a blob on the bottom. I said, I don't want any money for this. I wanted to go to the children's home, the one that Celtic were kind of almost linked with. It's actually up near Maryhill. Was it East Bank Children's Home or something? But whether or not they ever paid them that money. I think I was getting £300 for it. And I says, this isn't for the money. I went home that Tuesday night after the, which I never did, but I went home to see my dad because my mum had died a couple of months before it. So I was obviously quite emotional and all that anyway. I went home to my dad. I said, Dad, I'm going to lose my job. I said, but I've been looking at it. I want to go and swim with dolphins in Belize. Right? Like, because I've seen it on VSO. And he says, what have you done, son? What have you done? I said, I can't work for this board. So it looked like Steve, I think, was going to wait till the Thursday to sack me rather than the Wednesday because it loses a bit of momentum, doesn't it, with the sun?
Yeah.
It's not the... But then by the Thursday, you know, it was all like the board. Like, it was like, hold on a minute. Like, it's all starting to fall apart. You know, with the bank, we'd heard about the bank closing in, getting ready to foreclose because of the debt they had. And so Steve thought, I'll hang fire here. Because, you know, I might not need to sack him to serve this, because he can look like a hero to the new board because he's a guy who was willing to. I mean, I remember seeing something. It said, Matt McGlone said, I knew what was going to happen. And I was trying to make myself look like a martyr. I got on well with Matt, but that genuinely wasn't the case. I thought I was going to lose my job. But by Friday, the board were gone.
I mean, during that time, and that's what people forget, everything was so changeable. It was just as you thought something was going to happen, the complete opposite of what happened. And I always remember the best example might have been around the time of the Canberra Slang announcement.
Yeah.
So if you remember, there was the Wiseman Consortium as well as if
there was a
consortium, right?
There was.
And I remember speaking to Paul. It's far enough in the past. I'm sure Paul listens to Paul Watterson.
Oh, yeah.
Who was part of the Wiseman Consortium. And I remember I once asked him to come on the podcast and he said, I always thought it was quite magnanimous. His attitude was, I wasn't one of the main players.
So, and I'm not trying to say I'm a main player. No, I just
it's very. But I remember him telling me that they heard there was going to be an announcement, a major announcement by Celtic, and they'd had some background conversations with the club, and they'd made proposals that the club had said we're going to look at positively. And Gerald Weisfeld was in Australia, and the BBC contacted him and said, something's happening at Celtic. And he paid for his own, now this is 30 years ago, so it'd been very expensive. He booked a studio in Sydney or wherever he was in Australia and paid for his own satellite link to the BBC so they could go to him live.
That's right, I remember him being on one of those news programmes.
And because this was all booked, because again, for younger listeners, the days before the internet, the days before mobile phones, well, some people had mobile phones, but principally. And so that quick communication wasn't quite there. And all the noises, they thought actually the deal was going to get done. Weisfeld's consortium was going to get to buy.
Yes,
He booked a satellite and was actually sitting in the studio.
That's right. And in fairness to the old board, and that would be Jack and Tom Grant and all that, they recognised that Fergus was the better bet. Because I think Gerald Wiseman's consortium, their notion was to pay off the debt and then run it as it was. Because the reason why the bank were foreclosed, Celtic had a cash flow problem.
Mm-hmm.
They had a cash flow problem. And part of the cash flow problem, people forget, if people are talking about, was it Seltzer Change? Was it Brian Dempsey? Was it David Lowe? No, you know who it was that that changed Celtic's course of history in these 2 months? It was Lee Martin. Because Celtic went to a tribunal for the signing of Lee Martin. And it turned out the tribunal set it, I think it was 175,000 more than Celtic thought it was going to be. So there was a cash flow issue. There was an immediate cash flow issue. So Lee Martin was the man that, you know, for the want of a nail, the shoe was, you know, Yeah. So he was the kind of, you know, he was the nail in a lot of ways. Lee Martin, which he's never given his great credit. He was a mad guy, but he was a funny guy. Like, so Lee Martin is the man who saved Celtic as much as anybody else.
So you're in there. And you mentioned something just a wee minute ago about, did the board honestly just, my impression, because I once had a phone call with Kevin Kelly when all of this was going on. I phoned the trophy centre. Can I speak to Kevin Kelly, please? Yeah, who's calling? I gave my name. What's in connection with? I'm just one of his customers. I just wanted to speak to him. Hello? And I had a 45-minute conversation with Kevin Kelly about...
God love him. Yeah, why, Kevin Kelly.
Why... Yeah. About my issue with the club being run by a group of families and just didn't work out, and the world was changing and business was getting involved, and we were now getting left behind with stadium development and blah, blah, blah. And I just never got the impression, from that conversation, and when you read stuff, remember the guy Jerry McSherry used to write?
Jerry McSherry, yeah. That was, he was still there in my kind of Celtic View days.
Used to write into the Evening Times in particular. And it was basically the gist of it was all, and Michael Kelly was big on this, seemed to be, we just need time and we'll get it right.
That was very much his idea.
We just need breathing space. And it might be a longer journey for us to get to the point of where Rangers are in terms of, by that point, Rangers had the stadium and all that stuff. But we'll get there, because we just started later than them. It was my impression that they didn't see, that they just didn't have the ability to get finance to back them in the way that an astute businessman like Fergus McCann could.
And also, Michael Kelly recognised that, because therefore he brought in David Smith, if you remember. Mm-hmm. He was supposed to be the city man, the kind of London, he would get the London investment, and maybe he was the guy who got Geffener. Bizarrely, that Friday night when they were, so obviously we were all camped up, I think it was maybe in the Walford we were waiting for, because this was all, it was all happening that Friday night, and I was sitting with the other press guys and all that, but I'd had to go to the toilet, I had to go downstairs at one point, and it was just when they were leaving, just when the old board guys were leaving, and I was just getting ready to run back up the stairs, if anybody knows the front kind of the concourse of kind of Celtic Park inside, I'd just get running right up the stairs, and Michael Kelly just come out, and he looked down at me, and he just went, I trusted you, right? And I looked up, it was one of those moments you think, right, I've got to get my bon mots right here. And I just couldn't think, and I just went, yeah. And somebody misrelayed that story, and it appeared in the Sack the Board, the David Lowe's book. Uh-huh. They thought it was Michael Kelly looking down to David Smith, rather than Andrew Smith. So once the first edition came out, I said, oh, by the way, that's me for the second edition. They went, oh, right. So what they did is they took the story out of the second edition because I'm not born.
But it doesn't have the same gravitas as Michael Kelly bringing in someone who's going to be the guy who's going to be the business guy that will allow the families to stay on the board and have as opposed to an editor of the Celtic View.
Or as they called me in the Sun, because I had to walk across the car park, and they said, right, we've got a guy in a kind of bush and he'll take a picture of you as you're walking across. I walked across with my pad and my pen. Things, don't look at the camera, just look ahead and all that. So this picture appears, you know, the snatch picture, and it says under it, Media Chief Smith. But so that was the Friday night, and it was like, yes, like it's, and I must say, we'd been hoping that they would be pushed out. I remember my first ever day as a Celtic View editor, I'd been at Celtic View for 3 or 4 years, but my first day as Celtic View editor was Celtic went to Motherwell in the third round of the Scottish Cup. Tommy Coyner, swirling wind, headed past Carol Mogleton, Celtic's earliest cup, Scottish Cup exit for. And we knew then, and it's the only time I've ever gone to a Celtic game and wanted Celtic to lose. And it was, we were all feeling really bad that night because it was Donald Cowie who was leaving as the editor. It was his going away party. So, but folks said, oh, like, we were feeling bad that we wanted Celtic to lose, but we were in the mood to party because they did. Felt weird partying at Celtic Park.
But it was around that time that you were wanting. It was a bit like when Celtic lost for Tony Mowbray to get the sack. You knew that there was either going to be, we would have loads and loads of games, you know, death by a thousand cuts, or actually you just wanted, when we get, you know, when St Mirren scores four goals, you just think, well that's it, he's getting sacked in the morning, so at least it's bringing it to a head. And in that 93-94 period, you were looking for a series of hammer blows because it would just speed the process up. Rather than, and I remember there'd be a couple of occasions where just as you thought, right, this is it, we go and win like 3-4 games.
I know.
And you'd be almost irritated at winning 3-4 games because you think, this is all going to have to start from scratch again.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the Kilmarnock game. So, again, younger listeners, that's the one where it was boycott, we're boycotting the game.
Yeah.
I had a season book in the Jungle at the time.
Yeah.
And didn't go. And it's a real wrench, particularly because you're thinking to yourself, well, or wrench, I should say, you're thinking to yourself, but I've already paid for this game. So me not going, what difference does it make? But you decide not to go. Now, lots of chat that the board made the... did you guys hear anything? Because there was lots of chat that the board made the attendance. What was it? The official attendance was something like
9,000.
Was it not just tipped over into the 10, something?
No, it was 9,000 or something, and I think they'd clipboards and they were the monitoring attendance, the Celts for Change guys, and I think they said it was only 8 or something like that.
Yeah.
But it was 9. I must admit, all my family went that night. They all season ticket holders, and they still went because they just couldn't. They couldn't bring themselves to, rightly or wrongly. And I would have probably been with them. I would have been, because I got my season ticket. So I got my season ticket in the main stand and I got a job with Celtic 2 months later. So I never ever sat in it, like, you know. So it's been in the rest of the family for 35 years. I've never, you know, it's like bizarre, you know. Within, I only sat in it once or twice back in, so it was like 1989, and then I got the job at Celtic. And the day I started at Celtic, that's why I mean about how things you felt there was something brewing. The day I started at Celtic, the front page was some scandal to do with an employer. The back page was Roy Aitken asking for a transfer, and page 9 was Mo Johnson singing the sash at a Rangers supporters function. And I thought, is this how it's going to be? And it was. That's how it was. That's how it was. It was like, you know, you said about things moved and changed so quickly. You know what it was like for younger viewers or listeners or whatever? It was like the Trump presidency, Celtic at that time. There was something happened every day.
Yeah.
And it, then when Fergus come in, it kept happening every day.
Well, so one of my mates always goes on about, he wasn't worried about Rangers winning 9 in a row. He was worried about Rangers winning 12, 13, 14, 15 and 16 in a row.
We talked about that. We used to sit in the View office and we'd work it out and we'd say, well, they'll definitely win. It's no 10. It's like, they'll win every title this century, which was the 90s. I thought there was no way they were stopped. No other way they were getting stopped before the 2000s. We couldn't see it changing. Could never see it changing. I suppose plenty of Rangers supporters thought that going into that 10 in a row season, Celtic's attempted 10 in a row. You think things can't change in football, and then they can.
Yeah, but...
what?
There's a mass pandemic and one club in Scotland used a different testing lab to everybody else and didn't have anybody catch COVID. It was remarkable. Anyway, that's...
That's you.
So
the Friday night. So then it was.
Yeah, what was it like inside Celtic Park on that night?
It was great. It was great. It was like just a weight being lifted. It was just like it was the beginning of the rest of your life, Celtic. You know, that's what you felt like saying to this kind of Celtic entity, Celtic. This is the beginning of the rest of your life.
The whole impression you get of it is almost like McCann and his team were like the police had come in to clean the place up, and the Celtic board had all been convicted and been put into separate rooms to sign their confessions, you know, and some of them had to sweat it out more than us. That's the impression you get.
Well, some of them were allowed to stay, if you remember.
Yeah, so some of them signed their confessions and they were allowed to stay, and the other ones who didn't sign their confessions...
It absolutely broke his heart, Fergus, because they're not one thin dime that he had to pay off. I mean, Michael Kelly got good money for his shares, but he had to get him off the premises. But he allowed Kevin and Jack and Tom Grant, I think, all kept. They kept their shares because they wanted him, because they'd pushed for him, because they recognised that he had a plan. They recognised that he had a plan. So,
I always remember when coming out in the steps, Jimmy Farrell was with.
Jimmy Farrell was always, he was the enemy within. I remember sitting beside them, like, going to a European game, said, how are we going to get rid of this board and all that? You know, we work from underneath. Because if you remember the late night EGMs that David Lowe kind of brought in, because he'd realised there'd been all these unassigned shares and everything. He was buying them up, so you could get to a certain point. You know, it was like you could get...
That's right, there was quite a few EGMs,
and they went on to, like, the early hours of the morning. It was classic. It would make a brilliant TV series. It would make a brilliant TV series, because there was so much going on. But what you learned very quickly when Fergus came in, so the next day we went to the Marriott. So he had a breakfast, he had a lunch with the press and all that, and I tagged along, Celtic guy. And then Steve Sampson, this brilliant idea about we would get fans to phone in questions, and I would ask them to Fergus McCann for this next week. Fergus answers your questions. And it was like, so I was supposed to, Fergus was supposed to call me on the Sunday. So it got to 6, 7, 8. He was staying in the Pond Hotel up in Glasgow's West End. Mm-hmm. It got to 20 to 12, I remember. I can't see sitting in that. It was above the old pool's office. Again, people only know about where. What is that now? It's just a kind of garden type thing or something, isn't it? In the Celtic Way. There's nothing there.
No, there's nothing there. Would it not actually be where the car park is? You know, where the board car park is at Celtic Park now?
No, that was the old school.
That was the old school. It's just somewhere in the middle of the Celtic, top end of the Celtic.
Where it used to be the Celtic Pool's office, and above it was us in the Celtic View. So we used to sit in that office. I remember we used to sit, many Sundays we'd be working late, myself and Joe Sullivan, as it was later. And I always remember, used to hear an ice cream van about kind of 11:45. And I remember turning to Joe and I said, who the hell's going to want to buy an ice cream at 11:45? And he said, Andrew, how naive are you? How stupid are you? It's no ice cream. I don't buy a cone, Mr. Whippy, a 99 at 11:45. All right. And that naivety stalked me. And even these times, like the changing of the guard, the changing of the board. But I always remember, so I'd met Fergus just briefly, just before we were all going to Perth, because Celtic had played St Johnstone Perth, if you remember that day. Mm. And then in the Sunday, I'd waited from 2012. I said, Fergus, I've got some questions to ask you. And I'd seen the questions getting sent through for Steve. They'd people manning the offices, you know, in the centre of the town where, we actually produced the interview. And it's like, then I'm seeing these questions. It's like, if I don't ask all these, Steve will go, he's nut, man. So it was like, you could tell Fergus was tired. He's bound to be tired, you know. And like 2012, so I said, oh, I've got this question from Jerry. And it's like, hey, my seat always has a draft around it. And it wee Fergus, right? And it was like, this was about the 25th question. And there was about 12 before that about pie stalls. And you know, it's like quite old. People still do. They do it at the AGMs now. And it's like, hey, it's stupid questions. I can't anymore. It's stupid questions. I'm sorry, but I've got to get, because I had to fill the centre spread. So it's like, I was writing a shitty thing one centre spread one week, but it was shitty the next week, even with the board changeover. It's just, you know what I mean? Same meat, different gravy sometimes. But then I was at my high court, so he come round on the Monday, he come round the whole club to introduce himself. And Joe said, Andrew's not actually here. He said, he'd normally hear them now, but he's at the High Court. He's on jury duty. He said, hey, who's he? Hey, I know him. I know him. He's a snappy dresser. You know, because people thought I dressed rather slovenly all the time, you know. That's when you kind of got his kind of caustic wit, which he demonstrated time and again. I always remember one time, because his offices, he moved us, he wanted us away from the view, the pool's office. So he moved us into a watch, I think it's now the players' lounge, right at the bottom of the corridor. Right at the bottom of the corridor, he moved us in there because he wanted, and then he eventually moved us into this kind of rabbit hutch offices. You know, it was like, you know, those soulless American kind of call centre things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, because I tried to fight him all the way, and I said, we're a newspaper, we're different. He didn't want to see us as different for the rest of the... I said, but we're journalists, we're going to be interviewing people now, we need privacy. So it was like, I used to sit in an office, and then behind us, it was Alan Delott for the Walford restaurant, you know, so I'd just like to be taking bookings, and I'm trying... It was like, and it was hellish, But anyway, that was much later on. But he put us in an office right at the end of the corridor. But periodically, he would just walk around. He would just walk around and just go in to see people and all that. But so we'd be sitting there, because we all smoked. Again, for younger viewers, you could smoke inside then. I remember when I started...
It's not a smoking room.
There was a smoking room, aye. There was a smoking room, but that was even later. But we thought, we don't need a smoking room, because we'll smoke. Because he came over, and it was like Abigail's party. We had this ashtray. Do you know one of the big long things?
Yes.
The big mill. And you'd press it, the top would spin round, and all the things would click in the bottom. But it was like... I don't know, like, Joe, where did you get that? Like, it must have been in the pool's office or something. It was like, this relic from the 60s, but we used to. And it was like, honestly, Donald didn't smoke, but the rest of us didn't. And it's like, poor Donald. Because it was like, you know, the early episodes of Life on Mars, you know, and they're kind of...
So the reason is, because I remember I working in the civil service, it was the first time I experienced a smoking room, and you'd be sitting right in the way, and without even looking up, you knew that someone had come, had walked past to come in. Because it was like a cartoon character. They just permanently walked around, followed with a smell.
Do you know, when I went to the Evening Times in 98, in the smoking room, this, you know what I mean? That's the how kind of cynical journalists are, but it was called the Roy Castle Memorial Suite. You know how Roy Castle, like, he met his demise because he passed his smoking, because he didn't smoke at all. You know, but it was playing his trumpet in all these smoky jazz clubs and all that. Sorry, we're digressing. But so
reminiscing on the brilliant days of
so wee Fergus. Lung cancer. So he would come down to the office, like, he would come down to see us, because he'd say, I want this in the view, I want that in the view. Because, as I say, it always upset me. I see Tom Campbell was 90, like the famous Celtic story, he was 90 the other day. He wrote in a book about how, I don't know why he was mentioning it, but he said, how I was a vainglorious sort, because I'd written this piece about 10 years on for McCann, and it made it seem as if I was an associate of Fergus McCann. And he said, I've met the two men. They wouldn't have that kind of relationship. Fergus was a martinet, you know. You didn't work with Fergus, you worked for Fergus. Yeah. But I wrote this piece about, because he wanted things in the view every week, so you would naturally go along to see him. Mm-hmm. And he talked to you, and I remember when he was talking about the stadium and all that, I went, just bolt. I said, I can show you all the attendances for the last 15 years. If you bolt seats on the Celtic and the Rangers end, you can get 35,000. Celtic have never had an average of 35,000 seats. He said, no, that's not the way to go. I said, I'm telling you, that's the way to go. So it wasn't, when I wrote these things and all that, I wasn't trying to pretend that I was, Fergus McCann was listening to me, but you would have times, you would be able to say things to him, don't you, wouldn't it? You know, just because of the nature of what your relationship was, but... It wasn't me and Fergus McCann. I don't mean that at all, but I had quite a lot of dealings with him, and it was quite funny. But when he was used to walk along, so the first time he walked along, we were all sitting in the office smoking. This is a Celtic Football Athletic Company, you know, because they hadn't changed the badge and all that then. Yeah. It's a Celtic Football Athletic Company. And we said, well, we're not the athletes. We're the writers. Hey, I don't want you smoking in here anymore. I said, okay. So from then on, we had to post a lookout, look at the door. And then we say, right, smoking break. We'd post a lookout at the door. And this genuinely happened. They'd post a lookout in the door. And we'd all wear cigarettes. And then they'd say, and one time it happened, said, Fergus is coming. He's coming. He's coming down. I was like, shit, get the cigarettes out. And I threw mine in the bin. You know those black kind of metal bins that you get? Uh-huh. Like but it was a waste paper basket, if you like, right? So I threw it in the bin. I threw it in the bin, and the thing started smoking up, right? So I put my foot in it, right? to try and get the thing out, and it stuck to my foot. The bins. I mean, it was like a Brian Ricks farce or whatever you call it. So Meryl said, "Open the window. You know those big windows in those."
Yeah.
So she opened the window. So somebody pulled it off my foot and said, and it was still smoking. She said, "Just throw it." So she threw it, right? But what we'd forgotten was the players used to park their cars underneath there. So it bounced off this bonnet of a car. Can't remember whose car it was. Said, right, we'll wait till Fergus goes out and then we'll get it. And we're trying to, you know, but he kind of, so he didn't like the fact that we were a bit different.
Aye.
So that's why he got us in the kind of body of the Kirk, if you like.
But then it's really odd because you were Celtic, but not Celtic. Because you just made it, obviously, the View wasn't owned by Celtic. It was Celtic's paper, but not owned by Celtic. And you had a different master.
I did.
So it's a really peculiar setup.
I did. And he decided he was going to buy it back, right? Mm-hmm. He would buy it back that summer of 94. And before he did, Celtic had played out in Toronto in the Hamilton Cup in the June. And before I was going away, I said, look, can we get a reflection back in your first 3 months at Celtic, the end of the season, your end of season report, about how it's all going, how you reflect on how this happened and how you've got here and how you're here. He said, meet me in the Walford for lunch. Right, so, okay. Met with the Walford for lunch, and I remember I was sitting, I was thinking, oh, we'd have a bit of chat and all that. He's gone, like, because he was looking at his watch and all, he's gone, hey. I was eating my soup, eat faster, right? I was eating my soup, right? So I had this, but I did this whole, how it came about and why I should have done it years ago, because people forget that his original proposal to the board was, I'll give you $6 million to build a new stand. To meet the requirements, mm-hmm. And the only people that took him seriously because he had this whole plan, he would give them $6 million as a loan. They would give him it back. I don't even think he was looking for a seat on the board. Mm-hmm. And the only people who ran the story was the Sunday Scot, owned by David Murray. Mm-hmm. They were the only people who took him seriously. And it was such a weird turn of events that I suppose that he and ultimately would be the kind of the nemesis of David Murray in a lot of ways. David Murray's newspaper, short-lived as it was the only people to give him the credence he deserved. Because they had a picture of him and how the stand would look and all that, and it would get them over 20,000 kind of thing, so they thought it would be the start. But so we were taught about that, and I said, oh, you could have been here years before. And he said, but they stonewalled me. They lied to me. All the time, they lied to me. So I put this in. And by the time it was going into the View, I was over in Canada, so I had to fax it back to get typed in. You know, I was writing a longhand, you know, faxed it back to get to put in the View. And I'd said, I always remember, because you remember how you write it. I'd written the discredited directors, the old discredited directors. Mm-hmm. That's not a tab word, right? So what they did, they changed it to disgraced directors, right? So we got sued for this interview. Fergus got sued. I get sued as a writer. I get sued as the editor. And the publication gets sued. Celtic View gets sued. And I thought, oh, brilliant. I'm going to be in the front of the Evening Times walking out the court because I'm going to be able to say, I'm going to have my day in court. I couldn't wait. I thought, this is great. And then they said, so you'll need a lawyer. I said, well, I'm sure the club will get me a lawyer or not. Wee Fergus wouldn't pay it. Because he said, no, you don't work for Celtic. And I went, but you're just about to buy us back. You're about to bring us back in the fold. You're about to... He said, no, well, but you weren't working. I said, but it was your interview. It was you that... I was putting your words out there. Like, no. So, because Steve Sampson wanted to keep the publishing contract beyond... He was quite happy. Oh, Fergus, you can have your magazine back and all this kind of stuff as long as we get to keep mm-hmm. being the publisher. So he wanted to curry favour. So, and fairly, well, and also he was being decent to me, Steve Sampson. He had to pay my legal fees because I couldn't afford it. I was getting sued twice as editor, only for doing effectively Fergus's bidding as editor and writer. Although I would never have used the term disgraced. I think that was what got me. But I was so looking forward to it because...
So who specifically was suing you?
Michael Kelly.
Michael Kelly.
Yeah. Michael Kelly. And to be fair to Michael Kelly, a stroke of genius. He had a stroke of genius. And it was like... Because I thought, wee Fergus takes on everything. This is great. We'll go to court and this will be fun. Because I've got nothing to hide. I've got nothing to be ashamed of. I'll just tell the truth. Just tell it what it was. And wee Fergus said, no, he's settling out of court. It's like, what? Fergus is settling out of court? Fergus is settling out of court? A man who took Flamenco to court, remember, for like when they played the pre-season game and all that. He took
John Collins to court for...
John Collins.
The Bosman.
The Bosman. I remember arguing with John about that, and I said, Fergus, I think you're right, because they're not in the EU. Yeah. Monaco's not in the EU. But he didn't win that one, because he would have fractured EU law entirely.
No, it would have caused a...
It was great, but...
It would have caused too much of a problem for France as a country, so it was never going to happen.
But it was genius.
Yeah.
So, what? Fergus is settling out of court when it comes to my wee, puny wee case. I'm going to miss my day in court. Michael Kelly had the brilliant idea, because it wasn't just me and my colleagues, Merrill and Joe and all that at The View, that had to work for one old board to the next. Well, we didn't really, as I say, we weren't owned by the old board, but we had to... It was everybody else around Celtic. They were working for the old board, including one Elspeth, the future wife of Fergus McCann. So Michael Kelly called her up as a witness for the old board, as for against. So she would have to be in the witness stand against Fergus, because she wouldn't have been a witness. You know what I mean? She would have been a witness against this case. So, in fairness to Fergus, he couldn't have that.
But so, what was
she was? She was. She was a lawyer Michael, or something, wasn't
so
she?
Was Michael Kelly saying it was libelous?
Yeah, I remember he wrote us a letter, and it is
because you called them disgraced.
That was my one disgrace. Disgrace is a word that is libelous. Yeah, but they said that Fergus was libelous because he said they lied and they lied. They stonewalled me and they lied and they lied. That was his words.
All right. So Fergus would need to prove that they lied.
Yeah. So we got a letter and said, you'll have to stop. I think it was from one of the Kelly's families or something like that, saying, this is calumny, which another word, I didn't know what it was. What's calumny? I'll let you look up a dictionary. There's another, like, ones with the younger viewers, look up a dictionary. But calumny, I remember, I always remember that. And then it was like Kevin Kelly was saying, can I calm it down? Because obviously he was still kind of around and Michael was gone, you know, Michael was off the scene. So I never got my day in court. But it was like, there was a lot of these things. I mean, I was, as soon as the takeover happened, we decided to run a 4-page special, inside story of the takeover. You can just, you know, that artwork and all that, because these guys were all coming for the Sun and the Evening Times and all that. So it was all that kind of, and it was with Brian Dempsey. So within about a week, I had to take the pages down to Fergus, down, who was staying in Morton Vicourse. I think Morton Vicourse got Fergus's old place, you know, down those wee, the Clydeside, you know, the new buildings that they were then, you know, they built them.
Key.
I, you know where it was there?
Was it the Daily Record?
It was where they had the City Culture stuff and all that. Remember the...
So the City Culture on the other side of the Clyde. Was he on the other side?
I think he was on the other side.
The south side of the Clyde, so Mavis Bank Gardens, that's what it is.
Right. So I had to go down east and get him to go through.
Yeah. And they're like pyramids, those.
Yeah.
Apparently they were built to look like the bow of a ship. Apparently.
Oh, of course, they do look a wee bit like that. But I had to take the pages down. And so it was the part two, I think it might have been, of the inside story of the takeover by Brian Dempsey. And it was like, so he saw it. There was a picture of Brian Dempsey, his arm around the Seltzer Change guys. He says, don't want that picture in. I went, what? He said, don't want the picture in. Put another picture in. Put it something else. All right, right, whatever you want. So I phoned them up the next day. I said, look, we need to take those pages back, because we did 8 pages on the Sunday night. They had to be away by the Sunday night, and then another 8 by the Monday night. It was 16 then. So I said, we need to call back those pages and put something else in there. And Brian Dempsey, I don't know why, but Brian Dempsey phoned up and says, is everything going well and all that? How's it? And how's that picture I get? I think he'd maybe given me it. Right. How's that picture? I went, oh, it's not going in. And he went, what? I said, Fergus doesn't want it in. He went, what? So, like, then I said, sorry, I'm just telling you how it was. Like, again, a man naive, it's just, you tell people what's happening, you know. So then I got a phone.
He said, hold on, because I need to go. There's an ice cream van coming.
What is it? Is it?
When I pack up any Tuesday at 99.
So about 5 minutes later, Fergus phones, like, and he goes, what did you just tell Brian Dempsey? So I just told him the truth. And he said, come over here. And he said, Andrew, can you not see it? Can you not see what's happening here? Can you not see what this is all about? I went, not really, not like a, it's like self-promotion, people are trying to, like, it was obviously jockeying for, because at that point, Brian Dempsey, and everybody kept talking about it, because it obviously kept pushing the papers, he would be the chairman. Mm-hmm. But he would never be the chairman, as Fergus's eyes. And I'm not dissing any of the guys, but he needed, it was necessary alliances.
Yes.
Necessary alliances. You don't, I don't know if Fergus McCann's got any close friends. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but I can't imagine that there's too many people that close to Fergus McCann that he would walk off into the sunset with, as we kind of thought, oh, it was like, because we see them outside that night, the game is over, the Rebels have won and all that. You see them together. But he thought, right, I need Dempsey because he's the PR man. Right? It's like The Great Escape when you've got all the different, isn't it? The Tunnel King, yes. You know, the Forger. So you've got Dempsey. He's thinking, right, he can do the PR for this. Mm-hmm. You've got David Lowe, logistics. You know,
yes.
You've got
still loving.
Yeah. You've got Seltzer Change, muscle. You know,
yeah, they'll get the fans on board because I need the fans.
Yeah.
So the Seltzer Change can do the fans. Brian Dempsey's PR, so he's the link between the fans and money.
Yeah.
And whilst they are keeping everybody happy, I'll just do the thing that needs to be done. That's always the impression I got with Fergus.
Yeah.
That this is what needs to happen, but the message needs to be delivered to these people. So I need these people to help me get the message and to help me build the plan well.
Almost be a buffer to help me actually get on with it. Well, this is all happening over there.
Yeah.
But then it became happening over there for him because he'd think, hold on a minute, this is my, like, Celtic View, it was the club's newspaper, even if it wasn't owned by the club. But he's thinking, hold on a minute, they're giving the wrong message. So that was, but I was caught in the middle of that. It's like, what a little idiot. Completely caught in the middle of it.
So, because you're right, there was very much it was this magic team. It was,
yeah.
It was the A team. It was whatever you want to do that were coming in. But very quickly, once they were in, people just started dropping off. Dropping out of the setup.
They did.
Was it really obvious pretty quickly on the inside?
It was there it was. And I thought, hold on a minute, I'm getting this, right? I wasn't as naive after that. Because it's like, because then I'm sure he said to me one time, there can only be one vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the guy putting up the 8.5 million.
Aye.
I'm the guy. Dempsey.
Was it they say camels are horse built by committee?
Right.
you got to have one person, and that's it.
So he was obviously thinking, for better or worse, and he's not a collegiate guy. Fergus wasn't a collegiate guy, yeah. But and he'd done all these golf tours and all that. This had just been his brainchild. Mm-hmm. And I've seen Brian Dempsey say, in fairness to him, I've seen him saying it on certain podcasts that have been in it. Talking about the takeover 30 years on, he said, Fergus would say, I'm stick to the plan. But the problem was, Brian Dempsey didn't stick to the plan. Because I never forget that. It was like a ticking clock. It was like Heinen. Like, he needed 12 and a half million. So he was putting in the 8.5, I think. And I think Willie Hoy was putting in a million. The Weisfelds with Michael McDonald putting in a million. Dempsey was supposed to put in a million. I think, was it John Keane was supposed to put in? I think it was, so because he had this all worked out. It has to be 12 and a half million because I can use this in the stadium and all that. I mean, he must have sat and thought about this for years.
Yeah.
Sitting over there in Phoenix when he was moaning about the fact that they wouldn't get the super. But remember me and him and Merrill had a big argument about it, because he come past our office one time when we were on the wee rabbit hutches, and he was going on about the Super Bowl and all that. That's what, you know, he's living in Phoenix. And I said, you didn't get the Super Bowl because you wouldn't recognise Martin Luther King Day. He went, yeah, terrible. I went, no, it was great. I think it's great. You know, because I remember we went to Batumi, because he goes, hey, what do you think of communism now, Andrew? What do you think of communism now? I said, no, this is state capitalism. You know, this isn't communism. It's state capitalism, you know, because we had to bring all our own chefs and all that kind of stuff, you know. Sorry, I'm digressing. But so that was like, within that, I realised there was tension, there was pull. He was thinking, Brian Dempsey wants more for his 1 million than he should get. Mm-hmm. He should just put his 1 million in and let me go on with investing it and doing it properly. But Brian Dempsey was like, we should be a team. I should be the chairman.
He's putting in a million, so that's 8% of the money, but wanting 50% of it.
That's what Wee Ferguson's view was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what, but I remember that day when it was supposed to, and it was Will, Brian Dempsey put the million in, and it was ticking towards the 12 o'clock. And it, again, meeting him in London, because you just did meet him in London, because he was a guy who paced about and all that kind of stuff. You know, he sometimes paced about, and I remember, this was a long time, many years later, but he would pace about, and he would come in the morning, and he'd say, hi, morning, Fergus. He wouldn't speak. And I said to Peter McLean, I said, because that was his kind of consigliere or whatever, what's the word again? Like, you know what I mean? He's Tom and the Godfather. Yeah. So, and I love Peter, by the way. Like, yeah. We've gotten really well with Peter. He's been very supportive of me for ever and a day. But I say, Peter, you've got to tell him, he's got to say, when people say good morning to him, he's got to say good morning back. And he said, oh, he's got 100 things in his mind. I said, I don't care if you get 1 million things in your mind. It's no excuse for no, you know, just a kind of a shreddy kind of manners.
Yeah.
But that's what, you know, but so he was pacing about that day.
Yeah, but that's a frivolous thing in his head.
Yeah.
At that moment, that's something frivolous because he's got a really important thought in his head.
Yeah.
Or probably about 50 on.
So it went, and yeah. When he was really, see that day? I seen him really upset about Brian Dempsey, didn't he put in the... Because he would think... He got somebody else to put in 1 million, but he would think, ah... And it was all the chess pieces for him, wasn't it? It would have been all the chess pieces. He was just thinking about it all the time, all the chess pieces.
So apologies, it probably sounds as though it's stopped mid conversation, because it probably has. It was a good 2 hours that Andrew and I were speaking about his time working with Fergus. That was part one, available to everybody. Part two is only available if you are a paid subscriber on theCelticUnderground.substack.com. So log on. If you subscribe, you'll get content directly to your inbox every time written, audio or video is released. Or you can pick it up on your app, the Substack app. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night.
Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.